The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Northeast Credit Union,
helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of
auto, home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you
to discover the difference at
necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system,
improving the health of our communities for years to come.
Information at
imagine.d-h.org.
Word of
mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The phenomenal success of Star Wars, The Force Awakens, has resulted in a surfeit of toys and clothing, action figures, and games. But not everybody is happy with the choices.
So we just saw Star Wars 7, Force Awakens. Who's your new favorite character?
Rey!
Let's go see if we can find some Rey merchandise.
Joy, are there any Star Wars stuff in the girls section?
What does it look like?
You want Jar Jar?
No!
The Where's Rey movement has been gaining steam on social media since fans discovered that the female protagonist from Episode 7 was absent from several prominent product tie-ins. John Marcotte is founder of Heroic Girls. That's a website advocating for strong female characters in comic books, movies, and more. And John, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me.
So, John, for listeners who have not heard about this kerfuffle about Where's Rey, can you please fill us in on what's going on?
Sure. You know, the Star Wars movie came out, and for people who haven't seen it, and by the way, you should go see it. It's a fantastic film. The main character this time out, instead of Luke or Anakin from the prequels, is Rey, a teenage girl from the desert planet of Jakku. So women were understandably excited by this. It's the first time that they've been the central character in one of these films, but the toy industry didn't seem to have a lot of faith that either girls would go and buy action figures and related toys, or that boys would buy an action figure or a toy if it had a girl in it. So the toy industry really kind of dropped the ball on making enough merchandise with the main character of the movie in it, and they had some embarrassing gaffes, like Target put out an exclusive action figure set with Hasbro that had six characters from the movie and left the main character out. They had a generic stormtrooper and a TIE fighter pilot in there instead of the main character of the film, Rey. And Hasbro released a Star Wars Monopoly set that also left the main character of the movie out.
How did the manufacturers respond? I mean, how did they defend themselves?
Well, you know, they've had different responses when they've chosen to respond at all. Hasbro, for the Monopoly set, said, well, we didn't want to give away the plot of the movie. That was their excuse for not putting the Rey action figure out there. It's an incredibly thin excuse that really doesn't hold water much at all. She had already appeared in the trailer. We had posters and movie set photos. Everyone knew what she looked like. And I can't see how having her as a representative figure in a game of Monopoly would in any way give away the plot. You know, the thimble and the race car in the original Monopoly didn't give away the plot for anything either. It's just a token to represent yourself in the game. The Star Wars action figure set that I mentioned earlier from Target, the story was there was like that character wasn't completely locked down, but that also doesn't make a lot of sense. It's the main character of the movie. So they do have some excuses, but I don't think they usually hold up under scrutiny.
So there's been an update to this story making the rounds in online media. A blogger for a website called Sweatpants and Coffee says that he spoke with an industry insider who claims that the decision to leave Rey out of various toy lines was a calculated and deliberate one. But, John, you don't entirely agree.
Yeah, I mean, the story that the insider is peddling is that there was some higher-up instruction to tell manufacturers don't include Rey, that boys wouldn't buy her, so they were told don't put her in. I have a hard time believing that, although there are certainly large problems in the industry regarding representation. Disney and Lucasfilm, it's the first time they've ever made products for women for any Star Wars movie. Female fans, until this point, if they wanted a Star Wars t-shirt, had to shop in the boy department. So Lucasfilm and Disney actually have reached out in a way that has never been done before. They've manufactured all sorts of products for women. I think there was a problem in they didn't anticipate the demand. So the products they did make have sold out. And I think some of their licensors, the toy companies who bought the name Star Wars and are putting out their own toys, I think some of those companies did bet against girls. They left Rey out when they should have really included her in things like the Monopoly set or certain action figure sets. I think that's where the problem comes in. I'm not quite sure that this insider has a completely valid story. It doesn't quite jive with the things that I've heard from the people I know in the industry.
But this is a problem that extends far beyond Star Wars merchandise. What are some of the other female characters that have been shortchanged in the toy aisle recently?
Black Widow, one of the Avengers, is constantly left out of toy sets related to the Avengers. In the last movie, The Age of Ultron, she had this great, fantastic scene, one of the best in the movie. They put it in the trailer, where a jet comes down and she drops out of the belly of the jet on a motorcycle and then races off to rescue Captain America. It's a fantastic scene, very, very cool. So they made two different toy sets based on that scene, where you had a jet that would launch a motorcycle out. In one case, they put Captain America on the motorcycle, and in the other case, it was Iron Man. They took the Black Widow out of her own best scene and replaced her with a male figure. Gamora from the Guardians of the Galaxy, the same thing. She was a kick-butt female protagonist from that movie, and it was very easy to find toys of all the male Guardians of the Galaxies and the talking tree and raccoon, but they left Gamora out over and over again because the narrative is boys won't buy it if it has a girl in it and girls won't go in the action figure aisle at all.
Okay, so that's a narrative, but have toy companies actually been able to prove any data, any numbers that show that female action characters do not sell?
No, there's no real studies or anything to back this up. This is thinking that pretty much, solidified in the late 70s, early 80s, and just hasn't changed since. It's conventional wisdom, not actual raw numbers or data. And I can tell you this, when I was a kid, Wonder Woman was a popular television show, and I remember there was an entire aisle devoted to action figures and toys related to her, and they sold quite well. I don't see any reason why that wouldn't be the case today.
John Marcotte is with us. He's founder of a website called Heroic Girls. And we're talking about the Where's Rey movement and why toy companies often don't choose to invest in female action figures and even bet that they won't sell. So when companies do market toys for girls, they've been criticized for making, pink toys, feminized versions of the original products. I'm thinking of Lego, for example, launched a line for girls called Lego Friends, sold pretty well, but some feminist groups have argued that it is too, quote, girly. So is there a different type of problem from the one that we're talking about here?
Yeah, we talk sometimes about the pink ghetto that even when we make something for girls like Lego did, they make a completely separate line for girls. It's pink and purple. It has unicorns and flowers. Even though they're making a building set for girls, at the same time, they are very, very rigidly reinforcing gender norms. They're saying pink and pretty and girly and flowers, that's what it means to be a girl. And when you reinforce gender norms like that, you bring a lot of baggage with it. Girls that play with Barbie for just 2 minutes and are given a survey asking what jobs they can do will pick, flight attendant and librarian and teacher. But if they play with Mrs. Potato Head, which doesn't reinforce gender norms, they'll say, I can be a police officer or a pilot. It broadens their imagination when we don't overemphasize gender at every given turn. And that's what the problem with toys that are super pink and purple and flowery for girls brings to the table.
So, John Marcotte, where do you think we are? Is this a watershed moment for toy design and marketing? People really taking notice, really getting upset about the decades of toys being more and more divided by gender?
I think it is a watershed moment for a couple of different reasons. It starts with the movie. We created a movie that's a giant property that everybody loves that has a woman as the central character, as the hero. And, you know, when we're talking about marketing toys, they're losing money. Nothing speaks like money. And the fact that they sold all those Ray toys and they're gone, the ones that do exist have been sold out, and they have shelf after shelf filled with Kylo Ren, the bad guy, that nobody's buying, it's teaching them a lesson in a way that protest and other things simply won't. And that's, if you leave the women out, you're going to lose money. And I think that's the only way that we'll ever get through to these companies. And I think they're learning that lesson now.
John Marcotte, founder of Heroic Girls, thank you very much for speaking with us.
It was a pleasure.
Well, we've all known audiophiles who can only listen to music on vinyl. They say they cannot abide the low quality of MP3s and can hear the difference between digital and analog formats. But what exactly happens when a file is converted to an MP3? And does the technology really change the music? Emily Richards and Lorente dug into some of the bits and bytes behind our most ubiquitous digital format.
When software to compress music into MP3 files first came out, this was the number one song in the US. Back then, hard drives were tiny, and the easiest way to share music with a friend was to bring a CD to her house. But with the advent of the MP3 format, there was finally an easy way to send and store music digitally. Sure, that music was highly compressed, and yeah, lots of people have since complained about the quality. But there's one guy who's not complaining.
Oh, I'm feeling great about it.
That's Karlheinz Brandenburg, the proud father of the MP3. The method he and his team perfected for compressing music allows us to squeeze a big, beautiful, complex symphony into an itty-bitty compressed digital file a tenth its original size. But that wasn't easy. Compressing a file means reducing the data in it. But which data? It took Brandenburg 5 years before he was even close to an answer to that question. And then he tried compressing Tom's Diner by Suzanne Vega.
I am sitting in the morning at the diner on the corner.
Suzanne Vega's voice really got destroyed in some sense. It sounded like she had too much whiskey the day before.
That was in 1988. And it took Brandenburg and his team another 4 years to finalize the MP3. Compression still removed a significant portion of the data, but the lost sounds were virtually undetectable to industry experts, the so-called golden ears.
Golden ears who have done listening tests on this and completely liked the audio quality.
Check, 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 check.
Fast forward 23 years, and now this set of golden ears enters the picture.
Hello.
Ryan McGuire is a PhD student in composition and computer technologies. He's on a sort of sonic archaeology expedition to uncover the sounds that are lost during MP3 compression.
Can you hear me now on it or no?
The sounds that Karlheinz Brandenburg worked so hard to mask.
I'm just sort of fascinated by them. I think this idea of reducing the data by 90% in an audio file and then it's still sounding pretty good is kind of an amazing feat of engineering. And I'm very curious about what those lost sounds are.
So in addition to composing his own original music, like what's playing now, McGuire conceived of a project he calls The Ghost in the MP3.
It's very spooky.
He began by comparing an MP3 version of Tom's Diner to the original uncompressed song.
You end up with this stuff that was in the original sound that didn't make it into the MP3.
He calls that stuff ghosts. And you'll understand why when you hear this. Oh, that's so creepy.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of terrifying. When I first rendered the first file after I had done this calculation to figure out what was tossed out, and I listened back to it, I had this little sort of eureka moment where I heard it and I thought, oh my goodness, this is really interesting sounding. I could really make music out of this.
And so he did. It's called Modernist. Okay. Maguire could do this with just about any MP3, but right now he's working his way slowly through all of the songs that were used during the MP3 listening tests.
What do you think Karlheinz Brandenburg would think about the work you're doing?
I could see him taking it badly, possibly, and saying, like, you know, well, the MP3 is based on this perceptual model that all the stuff that gets taken out is not perceptible, and so I don't see the point. My hope is that he'll think it's interesting.
That's very interesting. Taking signals from MP3 and using that to create new art. I think that's marvelous.
Of course, as with any technology, there are trade-offs with MP3s. Sounds are lost, whether or not you and I can hear them. But by unearthing those ghosts, Ryan Maguire is turning digital artifacts into art. If you're interested in hearing more of his work, check out theghostinthemp3.com. His songs are available there as uncompressed files, or if you prefer another option, as MP3s.
And that story was produced by Emily Richardson Lorente as part of the STEM Story Project, distributed by PRX and made possible with funds from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation. Hobby drones are becoming a common sight in the skies. The FAA is requiring drones weighing under 55 pounds to be registered by February 19th. U.S. Transportation Secretary Anthony Fox says registration will improve the agency's ability to work with drone operators and make sure they're doing things safely and by the book. And if a drone goes rogue, well, that's where the drone catcher comes in. Dr. Mo Raskar is Associate Professor of Mechanical Engineering at Michigan Tech, and he's working on a robotic falcon to safely capture drones gone wild. Dr. Raskar, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you.
So how does the drone catcher work?
So it's basically a drone with a net gun, and whenever we have an intruding drone, we can send this system in order to capture it.
A net gun. That sounds fantastic. Does it do as it sounds? It shoots out and sort of grabs it in a net and reels it in?
That's how it works. The net gun has a canister with carbon dioxide. It shoots bullets that they are attached to the net, and then they carry the net, and the net engages with the intruding drone and then capture.
How big of a drone can it capture?
So right now we are using a drone, and this drone can capture something with the same weight and with the same size as itself.
Okay, so will it capture a drone that might have been malfunctioning? I mean, how does that identify the offensive drone?
So the idea is not that basically there is not an automatic way of identifying rogue drone. But the scenario that this system can be most helpful is that when you have a protected area and you know that there shouldn't be any drone in that area, like a sport complex, like airports, like when there is a crowd gathering somewhere, in that case, the system can send alarm, okay, an intruding drone is in the area, or the human patrols, they can identify the intruding drone. When they identify it, they can potentially ask the system and go and seize the intruding drone.
Is this meant for law enforcement to use?
But that is my actually real intention.
So is there any fear among operators that it might be used to steal other drones?
I saw some comments in online forums that they have these kind of concerns. But again, this is not the intention of the system.
Dr. Mo Raskar, Associate Professor of Mechanical Engineering, is at Michigan Tech and creator of Robotic Falcon. That's a drone catcher. And we've got a link to more on the project at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Need proof that America is auto-centric? Well, consider the abundance of parking. A 2011 study found approximately 1 billion parking spots in the United States. That is four times as many spaces as cars. Still, drivers waste hours and gallons of gas looking for spots. Urban dwellers can spend tens of thousands of dollars annually to secure a spot. Never mind the man shot over a parking dispute following the foul weather near Boston last weekend. Well, if planners and techies have it right, all that is changing. The combination of people choosing not to drive and the prospect of self-driving cars responding when and where people need them could well send the parking spot the way of the hitching post. Clive Thompson is contributing editor for the New York Times Magazine. He's a columnist for Wired, and we found his article, No Parking Here, in the latest issue of Mother Jones. Clive, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi.
So this 2011 study that you mentioned in your article, the amount of parking space devoted to parking larger than the state of Connecticut. How did we get here?
Well, parking emerged because when the automobile started to become more common, when, you know, middle-class families started buying them en masse in the 30s and 40s, you started to have a problem whereby cities didn't really know what to do with all these cars because people were leaving them at the curbside and they were running out of space. And so cities didn't want to build enough parking on their own, and they didn't want to build enough public transit to move people around. So they started passing laws, and those laws, they're called minimum parking laws. And the way it works is they'd say, look, if you're going to build a new house, if you're going to increase the population of this town, or if you're going to build an establishment, like if you're going to build an office building or a restaurant, you have to build parking so that when the people show up at home or at work or at the restaurant, they have a place to put their car. And those laws began to really exacerbate the amount of parking that was out there, because anytime any new building went up, a whole bunch of parking went on alongside it. This essentially also sort of conditioned us, the drivers of the cars, that wherever we went, there would be a parking spot, which made it really convenient to own a car, right? You know,
right, we expect a spot.
Exactly. Essentially, they made it really, really convenient to drive, and that made us buy more cars, which made us demand more parking. You can sort of see how that cycle starts to gallop along, and then that's what got us to 1 billion parking spots in the country right now.
And still, people fight over parking. But never mind the space. What is the cost of all of this space devoted to parked cars?
Well, there's a bunch of really subtle problems. I mean, on the one hand, you know, the easiest one is that they're ugly, right? I mean, almost no one goes, that's a really lovely parking lot you've got there. In fact, actually, I talked to an architect who said, you know, there's all these books of, like, you know, the 10 best buildings in the U.S., 10 best bridges in the U.S. There is no book of the 10 best parking lots in the U.S. So they're ugly. So that's one thing. But there's a lot more subtle problems. One of them is, you know, you get a lot of environmental problems because they produce huge amounts of runoff. The water can't go in the ground, so it all pools at the edges. You know, you get this flood of water that reduces topsoil and really destroys a lot of land. Then there's a really interesting problem of what they call cruising. So it turns out that in a lot of cities, you know, there's a lot of parking, but, you know, everyone's flooding into the downtown core to work. So it's hard to find a spot. People want a free spot. So there's circling and circling and circling looking for a parking spot. And what this causes is a lot more carbon output than you would imagine. When you look at your average, if you stand on a corner in a busy downtown core, even in a reasonably, you know, medium-sized or small town, you'll see cars whipping by you, and you think they're going somewhere. They're not. Anywhere from 30 to 60% of those cars are just circling looking for parking. So parking increases the amount of driving quite dramatically and produces a huge amount of greenhouse gases.
Yeah, I think you quote in your article, 47,000 gallons of gas generate 730,000 tons of carbon dioxide a year.
That was just for one town. That's just one little town in California. So yeah, you know, you have to multiply that by thousands or millions to get the full amount.
So what is it that leads planners or engineers and the like to think that the end of parking is coming? It's changing.
Well, part of this has to do with two big trends that are happening right now. So one of them is that ride sharing is really increasing amongst young people.
So that's the Ubers and the Lyfts?
Yeah, it's a bit of a misnomer to call it sharing. You're not owning a car and sharing it. So let's call it, you know, on-demand services. So in San Francisco a year ago, Uber opened up a thing that lets you pool a ride. So instead of a car by yourself, you can say, just put me in a car with someone else going in the same direction. And it'll cost a lot less. Like it costs, you know, sometimes as much as half. This is so popular that now 50% of all Uber rides in San Francisco are pooled.
Wow.
Because people are finding it, wow, that now they get to use a car, all the convenience of a car, but it's really cheap for just a little bit of inconvenience. A generation of people are realizing they can get around. They can use public transit, you can use a bike, they can use cars, and they will never have to have a car that sits parked anywhere. So this is really interesting. Now, the next big trend that's beyond that that I think has the urban planner super excited is self-driving cars. Because, you know, you think about self-driving cars, and when they look at them, they think a lot of them are probably not really going to be owned by individuals.
But so public transportation, self-driving cars?
Well, maybe owned by cities, but also owned by things like Uber and Lyft, or companies like that. Or a taxi company would just go, you know what, we're just going to buy 90 of these cars. And they're just going to roam the streets basically all day long. So it'll be what they call fleet-based. So whether it's owned by the city or whether it's owned by Uber or by a different cab company, you'll just have these cars roaming around all day long. You'll pull out your phone, say, I want to go somewhere, and it'll come along and, you know, odds are it'll be pooled, right? And there's been a whole bunch of studies that show that if you roll this out, they took all the traffic, the daily traffic in Austin, Texas, okay? And they said, okay, let's look at where everyone is going all day long. Now let's remodel that with a fleet of self-driving cars that intelligently share rides based on where people are going. And they found that it was just incredible. People were going where they had to go faster, cheaper. When you pulled out your phone and look for a ride, within an average of 20 seconds, a car would pull up. So think about that. What you're talking about now is, again, people in cars all the time driving, but those cars never stop anywhere. Like they never park. So you could have a city filled with traffic, but they never ever stop and park.
We're speaking with Clive Thompson, who's looked into how driverless cars could change the nature and the significant amounts of parked car space that is sitting idle and already devoted to parked cars in America. But what does this mean, Clive? I mean, that's if everybody is using self-driving cars. Is there a sort of critical mass or point where private cars, people who own their own cars, have to sort of convert to self-driving cars in order for this to work?
Yeah, that's a really good question. No one can really say exactly yet what that number would be. And you could also imagine some potential real downsides of self-driving cars, right? So imagine that instead of them being owned by fleets, you know, by the Ubers, by the Lyfts, by the city, by taxi companies, imagine that, you know, I buy a self-driving car. And, you know, now because I don't have to drive it, because I can read or nap or play, you know, a game on my phone, I'm willing to, you know, go crazy commutes. I can now live like 2 hours out of the city and just like, you know, sleep on the way to work.
Right. 'Cause
the car's driving me there. Or imagine I could say, okay, I show up at work and I'm like, I tell my car, okay, you know, just go find a parking spot somewhere in the suburbs. Come back and get me at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. So you could imagine that if individuals owned self-driving cars, we could actually have all the problems of congestion and all the problems of parking. Is there a solution to that? A lot of the urban planners I talked to said that probably what cities would start doing is preparing for this future and nudging behavior forward with things like congestion pricing, right? So you have this in London. Already London, very small, old roads, and they got clogged with traffic. So they basically said, look, if you're going to drive downtown, if there aren't several people in your car at any point in time, you're going to get a massive fine. And that very successfully created a lot of incentive towards carpooling and whatnot. And they think the same thing could work here in the U.S. You do congestion pricing and people will go, you know what, it's simply not worth it for me to individually own a car when there are so many cars driving around that I can just jump into. So it's a combination of cultural change that's already happening amongst young people and some intelligent policy could prevent some of the downsides emerging.
It is hard to imagine, however, people willing to give up the freedom of owning their own car. And, you know, you're talking about millennials. When polled, they're willing to give up their cars. But, you know, maybe that's before they have families. Maybe once you have a couple of kids and you need to be rolling around, things are different. I mean, what's the projection there?
Yeah, no one knows. And in fact, I heard arguments about exactly that this is not a generational change. This is merely, you know, the fact that they have not yet hit the childbearing ages, that it's become easier to be single without a car. But what are you going to do when when you've got kids, when you've got a bunch of stuff you need to haul around? Now, I will say, though, that like I think that, you know, when you look at some of these models and you see how radically easy it could be and how quick it could be to get a car, you can easily imagine that, you know, 25% of the fleet in a neighborhood with lots of families are like actually vehicles that are customized specifically for families, you know, like a minivan, you know, with child seats already in it. If you can get that pulling up in 1 minute, You know, I could imagine, I know a lot of families that find it, you know, an enormous pain in the butt to own a car. It's very expensive. If you can cut the cost of, you don't have to own a car and the cost of using those services is cheaper, oh my goodness, cash-strapped families would move towards it in an instant. Really, I think what we're talking about here is the question is, you said it really well earlier, you know, there's a sense of freedom that comes from having your own car, right? Well, why is that sense of freedom there? It's because up until now, if you didn't have a car, there was kind of unreliability as to whether you could get from point A to point B quickly. Is the bus going to come? You know, is the taxi going to be there?
Mm-hmm.
Smartphones, what they do is they remove the uncertainty. You're removing that sense of lack of control. But what a lot of people who use car lift services for a long time will say is that, you know, they can see the cars out there, they can see the map, they can see whether they're around them, and they still feel like they have some sort of sense of control. So to me, I think we may be seeing a genuine cultural break from the idea that a car equals freedom.
Clive, we've been hearing about this for some time, you know, the idea of self-driving cars, reducing accidents, there's no more human error, no more inefficiency. But still, do we know when is this projected to happen?
No, we don't, because there are one or two really big things that need to happen. So one is they need to be able to deal really well with snow. Right now, all these vision systems, like when you look at what the car is seeing, like they're sort of bouncing laser off things. And it kind of looks like you're looking at like a video game, you know, where you can see an old video game from the 80s. The car can see all these obstacles. Snow really messes these systems up. So, you know, the whole Northeast corridor, northern areas, at the moment, you could not have a self-driving car there. I'm pretty confident that they will figure that out, but no one knows exactly when. You know, if you talk to Google, they'll say, you know, we're thinking 15 years out, right? And the second thing that has to happen is governments have to basically say, we're comfortable with this. You know, we're going to allow these cars on the road. We think they're okay. We have developed new regulations to allow them on. And then you'll need consumer acceptance. People will need to feel comfortable getting in one and riding one. I've ridden in one, and it's an interesting feeling, you know, no one at the wheel. You're looking over and seeing the wheel turning itself.
I can only imagine. Clive, I want to thank you so much for your time.
It's good to be here.
Clive Thompson, he's contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine. He's also a columnist for Wired, and we found his article, No Parking Here, in the latest issue of Mother Jones. You'll find a link to read it for yourself at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Before the car became king in California, the best and sometimes only way to get around hilly neighborhoods of Los Angeles and San Francisco was to use a staircase. Producers Sam Greenspan and Roman Mars from the podcast 99% Invisible went in search of the secret slices of land devoted to public stairs.
Okay, this is Secret Stairs, East Bay, walk number 30.
If there is ever a place that's higher up than where you're standing, there's a reasonable chance you're going to want to go up. And wherever there is sufficient demand to move between two points of differing elevation, there are stairs.
Turn left, walking between the imposing gates onto Rockridge Boulevard. Yep. Note the line of very tall, very old palm trees ahead of you. Check.
California has a lot of hills. And in certain neighborhoods in our great state, you can find outdoor stairs.
Then, just past the house at 6095, find the almost hidden staircase that is your first climb.
Public stairs.
Let's see, 6095, 609, 6107, 6101.
If you know how to look for them.
Holy moly, I totally missed this. Wow, I walked right by these steps. And there they are.
That's our producer, Sam Greenspan, and as you may remember, he just moved to the Bay Area.
I think I knew California had hills, I just didn't realize how much of a thing it is here.
The large number of often hidden public staircases is one of the major reasons why the Bay Area is so great. The tourist crippling filbert steps to Coit Tower are not to be missed. The Monument Way staircase that leads you to my favorite place in the city, the pedestal of what used to be Sutro's Triumph of Light and Liberty statue. Ugh, and I go out of my way every single day to walk the two blocks worth of stairs by my new place in the Berkeley Hills. We have public staircases, and they rock. And the guy who wrote the book on East Bay public stairs is Charles Fleming. But he's not from here. The East Bay Stair book is actually a spinoff of his previous book, Secret Stairs of Los Angeles, which is where Charles lives, and that's where Sam tracked him down.
My name is Charles Fleming. I'm the author of Secret Stairs, a walking guide to the historic staircases of Los Angeles.
There's more than 30 people assembled here because one Sunday a month for the past few years, Charles has been leading public tours through the routes in his Secret Stairs book.
And we're here where Sunset Boulevard meets the Pacific Coast Highway in Pacific Palisades, about to embark on a stairwalk. It's actually stairwalk number 41 from the book Secret Stairs. And we will set forth here, walk up the Coast Highway a little bit, and then enter the historic Castellammare area of the Pacific Palisades, which features a number of striking public staircases.
And we're off.
Back before the tours, before the book, before he really cared about public staircases at all, Charles just needed to walk.
Yeah, I got started with the stairs because I was trying to walk my way out of a surgery. I had had two hip replacements and two spinal surgeries in the space of about 6 years, and I was up for a third spinal surgery. And I simply couldn't face it. I knew what the surgery was going to be like, and I knew what the rehab was going to be like. So I told the surgeon I'm not coming, because I had found that a little bit of walking relieved the pain that I was in. So I started walking flat streets, maybe two blocks at a time.
It was that hard to walk?
Oh, it was. I would have to have my wife put me in the car and drive me to a flat street and help me out of the car and watch me walk two blocks, pick me up and take me home. That was the first day. And, within a week, I was walking three blocks, and within a month, I was walking a half a mile. And because it was working, I kept going. And when I got bored walking the flats, I started walking the hills. When I got bored walking the hills, I started checking out the staircases.
So, first point of historic interest here.
Charles knew a little about the staircases. He had seen them around Silver Lake, where he lives.
The staircases are generally either from the 1920s boom years or from the days of the Works Progress Administration. They were built because developers in hilly areas needed to find a way for prospective homebuyers to get down from their houses to a school or a church or a streetcar line. But the Depression and then World War II halted staircase construction.
And after that, the car really became the dominant feature of the Los Angeles landscape. So staircases weren't necessary because they weren't trying to serve a pedestrian population anymore. They were trying to serve a car population. So they stopped building the staircases.
Charles looked for an inventory of all the public staircases in the city, but he couldn't find one.
So I decided I would map. I figured there were probably 15 of them, and I would make that my little quest.
Turned out that his neighborhood, Silver Lake, had about 50 public staircases.
But I felt so much healthier when I was done with that I decided I would do Echo Park too. I figured there were probably 10 or 12 of them over there. Well, it turned out there were about 60 in Echo Park. But I felt so healthy when I finished that I just decided to continue.
So Charles kept extending his reach to different parts of Los Angeles.
Pacific Palisades, where we are now.
And he kept walking.
Santa Monica, Hollywood,
Los Feliz.
And walking.
Franklin Hills.
Mount Washington.
Highland Park.
Eagle Rock.
Garbanzo.
Happy Valley.
And he kept walking.
And Pasadena.
By the end of it, he had recorded routes that use 400 public staircases.
400 and change. Well, over 500 that I actually mapped. But in terms of ones that I was able to turn into practical walks, 400 and something.
Mapping the stairs and making all the routes to connect them took Charles more than 3 years. At first, he just wandered aimlessly through the neighborhoods. But over time, his approach began to get a little more sophisticated.
Often it was just looking for hilly areas where streetcars used to run.
And then I gradually figured out that if you found a curvy street, a lamppost, and a sewer line, and a fire hydrant in the middle of a curve, there was probably going to be a public staircase.
Because if a city is going to retain ownership of a little slice of land, it's probably going to want to pack it with as many public utilities as possible.
These little slices of land often snake between houses and yards, and that's one of the great things about them. It's exploring, getting really close to someone's yard and house without actually trespassing.
But not everyone loves that these stairs are public. One set of stairs we came across was fenced off.
I'm not sure who put the gate up there. It's another public staircase that was open to the public until quite recently.
Charles says that at night, sometimes the staircases can get used by people looking for a hidden place to do shady business. I suppose it's possible that that could happen up here in the Pacific Palisades, but what seems more likely, at least in this case, is that someone fenced off the stairway to keep out the riffraff.
The staircases all go through residential districts, and because they go quite narrowly between homes, there are a number of staircases around the city that have been closed by the residents against other residents without any permission from the city.
Can they do that?
Well, they can't do it legally.
Charles has managed to get some of these fences taken down by leaning on congressmen and city officials, though some use less bureaucratic methods.
I know one fellow who just goes around with a bolt cutter and liberates the stairs.
We couldn't confirm this, but I just love the thought of a guy going around in the dead of night with a pair of bolt cutters, liberating staircases. This is my kind of vigilante. The idea of public access to the small spaces in between private property is in and of itself compelling, as is the allure of hidden passageways connecting neighborhoods across the city. But part of the magic of public stairways is that you just don't see public construction devoted solely to pedestrians all that much anymore. They feel like going back in time, when your feet connected you to everything around you.
LA is kind of a hard city to own. I don't think people feel an intimate personal connection to it the way that they might if they grew up in Boston or London. And I think part of that is that you're in a car going past it so fast that most of the city is just the name of an off-ramp. It's not, you don't have any sense of who lives there or why they live there or what it would be like. And when you slow down and move at pedestrian pace, it gives you the opportunity to get a little more connected to it. I think anybody would want that. I think as human beings, that's part of what is why we live in cities, why we live in communities.
If the streets are arteries, then the public walkways are the occasional capillaries that can get so narrow that only one red blood cell can fit at a time. And when you encounter someone on the path, you're forced to interact, to step to the side, maybe smile or nod. Also, it really feels like you're trespassing. I can't stress enough how fun that is.
And that story came to us from the podcast 99% Invisible and producers Sam Greenspan and Roman Mars. Thanks so much for spending some time with us today. We do invite you to share what you heard with others. Just go to wordofmouthradio.org. There's a deep list of segments to listen to or to post on social media or to email to friends. And please let us know what you are curious about. Those stories and sources that you're finding interesting or what's scratching at your sense of wonder. We find the best stories tend to bounce around by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott, inviting you to keep sharing them with Word of Mouth here on NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Molly Donahue,
Megan Tan,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
Our volunteer is Pam Maroney.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire
Public Radio.
All that glitters is gold, and she's buying.